Today, it's great to have Paige Harden on the podcast. Dr. Harden is a professor of clinical psychology at the University of Texas at Austin, where she's director of the Developmental Behavior Genetics Lab and co-director of the Texas Twin Project. Her new book is called The Genetic Lottery, Why DNA Matters for Social Equality. Dr. Harden, I'm so excited to chat with you today.
I'm really excited to be here too. I feel like we've been planning to talk to each other about this book for such a long time. So I've been looking forward to this one.
That's true. And there's lots of areas of interest overlap, but areas such as intelligence and the role of nature, nurture, free will, responsibility. There's so much to unpack. And, you know, I think we could kind of do it layer by layer. I think that's the best way of tackling the situation. But yeah, congrats on your book. How are you feeling about how it's been received? Congrats on the New Yorker profile as well.
Yeah. You know, I've been surprised. I think, you know, especially as the author of a first book and an academic press book, I really didn't know what to expect in terms of just, you know, what were going to be my opportunities to talk about the book and get people excited about it. And the New Yorker article obviously kicked off a lot of attention. And so I will confess to you, I'm a little tired. I think I was a little bit delusional about how much work it is to promote a book. And I'm also teaching my class this semester. So it's a pretty busy season right now. But it's a good problem to have the opportunity to talk to so many different people from different perspectives about what I'm trying to accomplish with this book. So,
yeah, before we get to what you're trying to accomplish and all the juicy bits of the book, I just want to just start with this question that I think that this concept that's so misunderstood, and that's this concept of heritability.
Yeah,
it's amazing how many people use the word heritability as synonymous with inborn, you know, unchangeable. It comes with like a whole network of things that actually shouldn't automatically be associated with it. So let's dispel some of these misconceptions right off the bat before we get into anything else.
Yeah. So, I mean, heritability is an old term, right? It, you know, dates from the early 20th century. And it's really about to what extent is the variation that you're seeing in a group of people that you're measuring due to the genetic differences between them. So, you know, you can describe heritability very simply. It is a statistic of genetic variation over total phenotypic variation or total trait variation. But you're right, it activates so many ideas of if something's heritable, it's innate, or it's determined, or it's bound to be a certain way, sort of regardless of the environment. It's immutable, or it's immalleable, or it's inexorable in some way. I have written a paper in the Annual Review of Psychology where I try to reframe that a little bit, and I talk about it in relation to another statistic that we often use, which is the Gini index, right? So the Gini index is a measure of how much wealth is concentrated or income is concentrated in the hands of few people versus equally divided. And that's a statistic that can totally change. It doesn't mean that there's anything about that distribution of wealth or income that's like preordained or destined. And we do see that Gini indexes change in countries over time. They differ, you know, from country to country. It is a snapshot of what is, but not what could be. And heritability works very similarly, which is in this group of people that I've studied, individual differences in something, whether it be height or intelligence or personality, are related to genetic differences between them. But it doesn't give you information about what could be if there's something about that society or group of people that was different, or what it would be if you studied a different group of people, if the population were different. And so separating genetics can make a difference without genetics being destiny is just a really hard, but I think really important kind of set of ideas that we're, you know, trying as behavioral geneticists to pull apart for people all the time.
Thank you. And I agree. But, you know, some people will use the argument you just said as a way of making the argument that the therefore heritability is pointless because it only applies to a particular population. But as you say in your book, I'm going to quote you, even if heritability estimates are entirely population specific, they remain an important summary of how much inequalities in life outcomes were caused by the outcome of the genetic lottery for that population. So I feel like there's a lot of on the one hands, on the other hands with you, which I like because I'm like that too. You know, I'm like, I have 50 hands, you know, on the one hand, other hand, third hand, fourth hand. So you're not saying that you're still saying that there's important information that can be gleaned from the heritability coefficient within that population because it's saying something meaningful about what is as well. You know, there is what could be, which is a separate issue we're going to get to today, but you still argue there's something important about what is.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting to consider that some of the most vociferous critics of behavioral genetics or the usefulness of heritability statistics have been from, not from social scientists, from biologists who really, I think, are tempted to think that if something is not universal, if it's not a law of nature that's true for all people at all time, then it's not valuable scientific information. Whereas, you know, as a fellow psychologist, you know that so many of things that we study are socially contingent, socially situated, historically contingent. And so we're interested both in the possibilities of how things could be if our social structures were different or if we intervened in some way. But we're also interested in the people we studied, you know, when we're thinking about like heritabilities are population specific. You know, we've studied from using twins and measure genetic methods, you know, people from America, from the UK, from Iceland, from Scandinavia, from Australia. That's not the whole world, right? That is a narrow slice of global diversity. And also, we're interested in what's happening in those societies, right? So you're right that I'm like you, a kind of both and thinker. It's not everything and it's not useless either.
Great. It's like saying, you know, let's say I'm growing up in a really poor environment where there's not a lot of food. It'd be like saying, oh, well, we don't have to worry about giving them more food because if we put them in a different environment where they had food, then they'd be fine. So let's just not worry. I mean, and when you put it that way, it sounds ridiculous, right?
Yes.
So that was just my on the spot analogy to the situation. So another misconception about the heritability coefficient, which is a very common misconception I see, is people think it somehow means anything about parsing the sources of nature, nurture determinants within a person.
Which is
ridiculous. It's only a parsing variation among people. It doesn't have a meaning within a person because within a person, nature and nurture are always intertwined, right?
Yeah. I mean, in the development of any one individual, it's always nature and nurture. And, you know, I give this example in my book where, you know, if you went out to eat at a restaurant and someone said, well, what's more important for your restaurant experience today, having salt in your food or having a chair to sit in, like that would be a ridiculous question, right? Like you obviously there is the food that you're eating and then there's the environment in which it's served and those are wrapped up together. You can, however, say if we're looking across restaurants, do restaurants that have worse seating have more dissatisfied customers? And that's a very different question than, you know, to what extent is this, are these things combining within the development of an individual? So again, heritability is, I say it's both more limited and more useful than its advocates and its critics often allege. It's giving us information, but about a very particular question, which is, you know, within a group of people at this particular place and this particular time, what are the differences between them? How are they related to genetic differences between them?
Great. You know, I've always, a metaphor that always resonated with me was nature via nurture. Mm-hmm. You know, this idea that within a person, and again, I'm going to zoom in on the within person level for a second, zoom out from the heritability level, but to the within person level, it seems like you can't separate, you know, you can't say, well, you're born with lucky genes and let's put that on the side. You're born with a lucky environment. Let's put that on the side. It seems like there's some meta luck that involves the molding and the constant interaction and interplay between the two within a person that you can't ever tease those two apart as two separate things within a person.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think this is part of what makes genetics fascinating to people, but also dissatisfying to people is that, you know, when we're trying to retrospect on our own biographies, we're as storytellers, we're trying to say like, well, it was this and then this and then this. Right. But we don't get to see the counterfactuals for our individual lives. And so we can tell ourselves stories about how we came to be, but we can never really know for sure. And then science seems to promise some sort of more definitive answer, which is why I think people get fascinated by the study of genetics in relation to aspects of ourselves that we think of as part of our identities. And yet scientists like me are always giving somewhat dissatisfactory answers, which is that I can't tell you that you are the way you are because of your genes. I can just say that on average, people are different from one another because of their genes, which doesn't feel nearly as gratifying to our storytelling selves, I think, as we would sometimes want it to be.
Yeah, it raises so many issues. One issue that a lot of this raises is what can one take credit for? This is a very fascinating question. I sent you a paper by my intellectual hero, Abraham Maslow. It was supposed to be his APA address, and it remained unpublished, on biological injustice and free will. I think I want to write more about that someday. But I just want to kind of just riff on this a little bit. He asks, what can one take credit for in one's life? You know, as you point out in your book, you're like, my daughter has verbal precocity. It's not like she really should take credit for that, you know, it's not. But I want to just push back on that thing, because you don't know the extent to which that verbal precocity was a result of her, genes. I mean, you didn't measure her polygenic index.
No, I don't. So, I mean, I'm extrapolating from what I know generally about the heritability of speech-language disorders. But again, you know, why does any one individual child turn out the way they are? You know, I think any parent will tell you that their children feel miraculous and mysterious. Like, where did this person come from? You know, like, she'll say something and I'm like, you grew in my body and now you exist as a separate person from me. And, you know, you were your own person. Explaining it, that individuality is always impossible. But we, you know, to go back to your thing, like, we do know that on average, if you're exposed to a normal linguistic environment in the home, that most of the variability in whether or not you have a speech language problem is heritable. And so, you know, thinking about to what extent, I think with that example, it would be very strange if we were like, well, we need to hold, you know, my child who struggles with speech, like, we need to hold him responsible for that, right? Like, that was, again, I think part of the luck of the draw. And so the relationship between genetics and responsibility is just really, really interesting to me. And I think so many of the controversies that we have about heritability are actually really underneath them conversations about who should be responsible for what. Are we passing the buck on social responsibility?
Absolutely. And what I'm really interested in is the other side, giftedness, intellectual giftedness and creative giftedness. And I wrote a whole book on this called Ungifted. That was the title of the book. Just trying to understand, you know, this kind of assumption that a lot of schools have that intellectual giftedness is inborn to a certain degree, and that we can measure it really early in life and that it doesn't change. You can't start off ungifted and then become gifted is kind of an assumption in our education system that I have been trying to challenge that notion. I like to see it more as a moving target, you know? But it just makes me really think about, you know, I think people might, like, you may even in reading your book, I think you fell prey to that a little bit yourself in saying, well, if my daughter has verbal precocity, should I give her credit for that, kind of assuming that maybe that came from the genes, you know, whereas I would actually push back a little bit and for the sake of an exciting conversation between us to just say that, you know, for some that may be the case, But I actually think we need to leave room in our education models for giftedness to develop in a result of something where they didn't have the inborn, or in, I don't like that word inborn, but they didn't have the proclivities, the genetic proclivities that would make it easy for them. But that actually, even if it did make it harder for them to get there, they still got there at some point, and then we do give them credit for that. So I want that kind of nuance. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So I kind of have two thoughts and sort of in response to that or in association to that. And first is I just find the language of giftedness to be so fascinating, like a gift from whom. And I think it relates also to just kind of a more general thing that I hope we get a chance to talk about, which is like how we think about skill in America and what skills are valuable. Like, I think so often when we're talking about giftedness, there's this kind of implicit assumption that the same skills would always be valuable, sort of regardless of where the child found themselves. But if we think about, you know, which skills are valued by other people in an economy, you know, we certainly overlook some gifts in terms of their talents and, you know, kind of overly fetishize, I think, some other gifts or some other skills in relation to that. And also, I mean, I think you're right, like that there's this, you know, in writing the book and using that example of my kids, you know, I'm trying to, my intention in telling that story is try to get at, I want to trouble people's intuition that genetic difference is always allied with superiority or inferiority. I think from the perspective of a parent, that attitude of these people can be valuable to me in equal ways, even if they differ in skills that are valued differently by the external society, it could just be really hard to convey in a non-abstract way. Whereas I think thinking about the perspective of a parent, that idea becomes more intuitive. But you're right that there, like what's missing in that story is change over time, right? And developmental plasticity. I'm thinking, so the other kind of thought I have in response to this is I had read David Epstein's The Sports Gene a while ago, and then I reread it after I finished writing my book. And I was really struck by how similar some of the content and themes were in a very different domain of human skill. He's talking about athletics. And he has this whole chapter around, you know, never being the fastest runner at the beginning of the season, but being the person who responds to practice. And what a gift it is, in a way, to not be the fastest one, because it's motivating him to like put in the work and the effort. And that part of kind of like plasticity and agency in acquiring skill, I think is missing in that description that I have about how I've seen skill differences in my own family.
Absolutely. And I'm a big fan of David Epstein's work and him as a person. He's a friend and a really good guy. Absolutely. Let's riff on this a little bit by me quoting Maslow from that unpublished essay. Yeah. He said, there's a danger in adhering to a single pecking order or a single monolithic hierarchy of superiority and inferiority, which seems like that could have come right out of your book too, that line, which is exciting. Perhaps ultimately each human being is a hierarchy into himself or herself, because in the final analysis, one's task is to be oneself well. And of course, there's no rival in the whole world for this task. I love that. I love the way you write.
I love that. Yeah, I think that's wonderful.
Yeah.
I mean, I also think it gets at, you know, so much of the controversies that we have around genetics, I actually don't think they're about genetics. Like, we get agitated in conversation when a genetic starts getting attached to traits that are used in an economic system in this kind of strict pecking order of inferiority and superiority. And it's, you know, I say this in my book that people are very wary of genetic determinism. And we've already talked about like why heritability does not imply genetic determinism. But I think we also need to be wary of what I call this kind of economic determinism, this idea that some skills can always be inherently more valuable than other skills in this really kind of strict way. And so I love this idea that Maslow's talking about, like when we, you know, the problem isn't that there's genetic differences between us. The problem is that there's a pecking order that's so inflexible And so intolerant of different domains of human skill.
100%. And I really like how you talked about the history of intelligence testing, and because the history of intelligence testing is intimately in America, I want to say in America, yeah, is intimately bound up, you know, with Goddard. You know, Louis Terman had very good intentions. Binet had really good intentions in France, you know, with the initial attempt at a test. He never called it the intelligence test. It was the Americans who put that label on it. He wanted to be able to come up with a test that would help people who needed remediation. In an education system, from those who didn't need remediation, kind of sort that out and figure out a better way of figuring that. In France, they never ended up using his test. And he died of feeling like a failure. At the very end of his life, there's a really poignant essay he wrote where he said, "I'm starting to see how the people on the other soil, American soil, are starting to use my test. And it's made me regret that I ever did this." So it's really a sad essay, you know, and very poignant. So in America, there really was intimately tied up to the science of intelligence testing, eugenics, the idea of the feeble-minded, right? Yeah. All these things were. So people, rightly so, have a knee-jerk aversion to the science of intelligence, which I think is unfortunate, considering that I do, and I know you agree with this as well. This is why we're kind of the one hand, other hand kind of people. There is a legitimate science of intelligence. There is a field that is studying it from an individual differences perspective and finding that it does predict lots of things in life. We can't sweep it under the rug, and there is partly a genetic basis to it, and which influences our biological aspects that influence our intelligence differences.
It's very similar to, you know, what we were just talking about with heritability, whereas it's not, you know, people can respond to the overinterpretation of a scientific idea with this kind of pendulum swinging the opposite direction of this is useless or can only be used for harm, and trying to articulate that both the limitations and the value of something. So, you know, we know that the types of problem solving that are tested by standardized IQ tests do predict things that we care about, including, you know, as you know from the Lothian birth cohort studies, how long people live. At the same time, they're not markers of all human talent or skill. And we wouldn't want to live in a society in which everyone was, you know, very, very good at spatial rotation and nothing else. Like, that would be not a society that we want to live in. And so how to recognize both the diversity of skill, but also the kind of the fact that we can measure something about people that matters for their lives as it's currently constructed, that both and is, I think, often really hard to convey to people.
Yeah. So exactly this, you know, they ran Twitter, this, what you just said. Yeah. This. So people say exactly this, you know. You know, just to play a little yes and here, improv game, you know, intelligence is, you know, not a measure of human worth.
No.
This is the point you're trying to make here, is that none of these specific heritability coefficients of any individual psychological trait, anything, is a measure of the totality of a human being or a measure of the intrinsic worth of a human being.
Yes, definitely. And I would say further, we have to go beyond lip service to that idea. So when we're thinking about the ways in which labor markets are structured, in the ways in which educational systems are structured, in the ways in which people have access to the ingredients of a good life, if we're saying that intelligence is not a measure of human worth, then I think we need to consider to what extent is our society set up so that people, regardless of how they end up in their measures of intelligence or in their genes relevant to kind of any specific skill, have access to those ingredients of a good life. We have to go beyond just saying that we don't think that IQ equals human worth to actually reflecting that in how we set up social structures.
I was going to talk about that kind of in part two of our conversation, but now you bring that up. I'll just dive right into it. you know, it's a very interesting argument because it seems to, it feels like it feels a little political. It feels like
a wee bit political. Yeah, I think that's right.
I feel like it's just hard. There's no way around it about that philosophy of life you have about why we're here on Earth to help the vulnerable seems to conflict with other political views or even personal philosophies of what, you know, we're here on Earth to do, which some people might say. We're here on Earth to develop our excellence, to put all of our attention into developing our own personal excellence as much mm-hmm. as possible, and that'll have a trickle-down effect on helping the vulnerable. So how in the world does one extricate, where does the science end and the politics begin?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a real, you're, I mean, I think you're picking up on such an interesting and valuable tension, which is also related to, like, what is your role as a scientist and as a science communicator to be transparent about your own political values with which other people might agree. So I think of this project as very much coming from a space in which I have my personal political and moral commitments, and I have a research career around studying genetic difference in relation to social behavioral outcomes. And I know from long experience that intuitively those two things, which seem really coherently connected in my own mind, strike other people as wildly unintuitive, right? Like, what do you mean you are a egalitarian behavior geneticist? I really think of this project as saying, you know, these are my values. This is how I think the science is consistent with that set of values. I think articulating that as clearly as I can is important for helping shape the larger conversation that we need to have about how to use genetics. But I don't think that, you know, any one scientific finding commits you to any one political ideology or moral ideology. So that, you know, walking that line, I don't know how successfully I did it in the book, of trying to say, you know, this is how I make sense of this, given what I find valuable about, you know, given my moral frameworks. You might not share them, but there's relatively few voices that are articulating how these things go together. So maybe you'll learn something from the interpretation of the science or from the way I see the role of luck in human affairs that might, you know, expand the kind of space of conversation that we have right now.
Look, you bring a fresh perspective to this topic. There is no doubt about it. In my own career, like within Gifted, I tried to be as impartial as possible in the sense that I tried to present all the evidence and say, well, what does it all mean? You know, what, you know, kind mm-hmm. of lay it all out there on the table for us all to look at and then say, okay, what do we make of the truth? Now, and so I really respect and like what you're doing because I get a similar sense. Even if we don't necessarily agree 100% with the politics of it, I would say that you're a really important balancing force for the study of behavioral genetics, and especially particularly the people in the general public who take the behavioral genetics findings and then start to use it for their own political purposes. And along those lines, it would be impossible not to mention Charles Murray and the bell curve, which you are sick of talking about. You didn't tell me that, but I'm sure you're sick of it. but we would be remiss not to mention that because I feel like if it's a seesaw, the seesaw part on the right is the link between behavioral genetics research being used to discuss the futility of certain social programs, and the left seesaw being just, I guess, your view, which is not the opposite. It's just balance of you know, look, there is stuff we can do, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I actually feel like in this seesaw around social intervention, psychological interventions, educational interventions, I actually feel like I'm not even on the seesaw. Like I'm trying to, you know, introduce a new dimension to this conversation. You know, I really feel like most of the back and forth has been people, one group of people saying, because things are genetic or heritable, some measure of inequality is inevitable and our social programs are sort of destined to failure. And another group pushing back against that and saying, obviously we can intervene, and genetics are a distraction from that. They're either a moral distraction, or they're a resource distraction, or they're just like undermining support for this, and let's like minimize. Whereas my point is, I do think interventions can be successful, but figuring out where to intervene that's going to be the most effective is really, really hard to do as a scientific problem. Like, politics and morality aside, like, just as a social science problem, designing successful interventions, especially designing successful interventions that are preferentially benefiting people who are most vulnerable rather than the kind of more Matthew effects, is a really, really hard problem. And so it's not genetics as a distraction from social policy or genetics as a limit on the effectiveness of social policy, but genetics is a tool for social policy, which I think is a perspective that's really been missing in most of our conversations for decades at this point.
Yeah. You know, I was curious, and I went back and read Arthur Jensen's much maligned, how much can we boost IQ and scholastic achievement in Harvard? Have you read the full report? Have you read his full thing?
Yeah.
So I reread it in preparation for this, and I reread the bell curve. This,
All like 150 pages of it or whatever.
Yeah. And I wanted to just see things as they are, not as
people tell me I should read it in public conversation. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I want to do something. I want to defend Arthur Jensen for 1 second to a certain degree. I don't think anyone's all good or all bad, right? Or everyone's all has the truth, and everyone's either all truth or all wrong. So I reread that report, and what I got a sense in reading that report is he says straight up in even in the abstract that there are environmental and there are genetic and non-genetic influences on intelligence. And he mentions things such as prenatal factors, such as nutrition, length of pregnancy, maternal stress, and intrauterine environment has an effect on infant intelligence. And he says postnatal environmental influences have not been found to markedly affect IQ, with the exception of extreme isolation. So there's maybe where he goes a little awry.
For real.
But well, something that is fair that both him and Murray point out is that even if we can acknowledge that intelligence differences between one person and another, we're not talking about group differences yet, between one person and another has a genetic basis and has an environmental basis, no one has actually ever come up or have found a program that has substantially increased IQ. So to a certain degree, they're actually right in that, right? I mean, have you discovered anything, any large-scale program that has substantially moved the needle on G or general intelligence?
Yeah, I mean, I would push back against that. I think we have evidence. The thing is that they're pretty broad brush things, right? So like, we clearly know from some adoption studies that, you know, being adopted into a wealthy family relative to staying in the like the home environment by your biological children, by your biological parents. This is that Ken Kindler and Eric Turkheimer study that used, I think, Swedish registry data from a couple years ago, does appreciably increase average IQ scores. And then I also think that I mean, this is very much the Heckman point, which is that even if things don't move IQ, they might move other things that we might care about more, right? So do we really care about measured IQ scores, or do we care about labor market involvement or avoiding contact with the criminal justice system or kind of other sort of ingredients of a good life, adult outcomes, not so much measured IQ scores? So, and then there's also Elliot Tucker-Draub and Stu Ritchie's meta-analysis of just the effects of education on IQ, right? So raising the compulsory school leaving age, or I think we're going to see a lot of interesting research in the wake of COVID-related schooling disruptions about how formal schooling and different forms of alternative schooling have affected trajectories of cognitive development. So I don't think the message is that nothing has been shown to work. I think it's more of those really kludgy, you know, being adopted into a wealthier family or going to school longer, what are the key ingredients of those? Can they be replicated? Can they be scaled? That's the part that I think is really challenging to do. But I would definitely push back against the idea of focusing only on IQ scores as our metric for successful intervention.
I completely agree with that. And those points are excellent. I'm trying to see if we can give the benefit of the doubt at all to Jensen and Murray in the sense that their focus was intelligence and maybe they were being good scholars at the time. In a sense, Jensen was brave for saying a lot of things he was saying based on the available evidence. On what is the current evidence? This is, I think, from the 60s. He wrote this paper. It was the 60s or 70s. Based on the available evidence base, and I'm only going to focus on intelligence. Mm-hmm. He made the point that no large scale socially governmentally sanctioned program has significantly if you improved it. Now, if you were wanted to be a good scholar, and you probably would have come to the same conclusion, right? In if you're writing that report. Given that you were only focusing on intelligence, you were only, you know. So I'm just trying to give him a little bit of the benefit of the doubt. We're going to get to group differences in a second, and where I give him much less of a benefit of a doubt. But I think that even Charles Murray in the bell curve, he stuck to a lot of the available evidence, which was nice. And he did even in the group differences section did say we need to be wary about extrapolating this too much to the group differences level. So I thought that was interesting. Just rereading his report, I was like, that's interesting.
It is a good exercise to go back to the primary sources rather than, as you know, what you think someone has said and what they actually said when you go and read them or not always the same thing. I mean, I think it's a good point too. In the ways in which I think sometimes the response to Jensen and then Murray has been counterproductive, which is if someone is blending things that are definitely true, could be true, speculative and contentious, there's a temptation to throw the baby out with the bathwater, to say that all of this is bullshit. You know, all of this is wrong. And this is going back to our conversation about intelligence. So often the response to the bell curve was like, there's no real science of intelligence. Heritability is meaningless. We can't study anything with IQ test scores. And I think that's counterproductive because it's so easily countered, right? Like, it does not take that much of a Google Scholar search to find that IQ test scores predict things that we care about in populations. Mm-hmm. So, I've definitely, this is an ongoing project, but I think thinking about, okay, here's an argument that's causing me agita. Like I'm responding negatively to it. What is the falsehood here and what is the truth here so that I don't back myself into a corner where I'm saying really intellectually indefensible things. And obviously that's always a moving target and I could always be doing better with that. But I think the extent to which the bell curve points out that you can measure IQ and it predicts labor market outcomes, backing yourself into a corner saying that IQ doesn't predict labor market outcomes doesn't really do you much good, I think, in countering the arguments that maybe people find the most objectionable about Murray's thesis.
Absolutely. So let me just lay out the argument I made on gifted, because I try to lay out on the table all the available evidence and then say, well, where do we go from here? You know, it seems to me like probably futile, and but I would go step ahead and say a red herring to focus money on large scale socially governmentally sanctioned programs to specifically target IQ or general even the G factor, you know, general intelligence. That it would be much, much better use of resources to help with individual student self-actualization in their own way, in their own time, their own developmental trajectory, their own dreams, desires. You know, you have a lot of these intellectually precocious kids in gifted education classrooms that are bored out of their mind because we're treating them like they're these robots where the only thing that's value about them is their IQ score. When what they're really yearning for is meaning, purpose, being things that are fundamentally human, things we don't need to separate out a special room for, you know, the purpose room, and then kids who don't have the purpose. We don't need to be doing that. You know, there's something fundamentally human that we all have. So, you know, my on the one hand, I've published data showing that the correlation between the G factor extracted from a large battery of IQ tests and an academic achievement factor extrapolated from all the different areas of academic achievement is the latent correlation is 0.96. Yeah. Holy moly. Yeah. Like that's let's put that on the table. Let's put it.
Yeah. But then say, I mean, we maybe see we're that focusing like in the wrong Texas things. Twin yeah. Project. Yeah. Like yeah. we give people in our sample a battery of executive function tasks, which are very basic cognitive ability tasks, as you know. So we give them 12 EF tasks that tap working memory, inhibition, updating, and switching. And these are things like the NBAC, right? So these are things that are not the direct target of instruction by schools. A general factor of executive functioning in our sample is nearly 100%. It's over 90%. And Naomi Friedman and her group at Colorado have replicated that finding. So we're seeing this in, you know, very highly heritable general factor of how well on these computer-based lab-based tasks children, you know, regulate and switch their attention and can keep things in working memory. Recently, my graduate student just completed a project where she obtained official school transcripts from all of the kids in our sample, and that include their STAR test scores, right? So the tests that they have to take at the end of every year, mandated by the state of Texas. I talk about this result very briefly in the book because it was still in progress. But what we find is about a half to three quarters of the variation in kids' STAR test scores is related to heritable variation in executive functioning, right? So we have this thing that's testing. Yeah, like what, you know, that's curricular tied, how you are learning the math that's taught in your third grade classroom. And then we have, you know, these working memory tasks, updating switching tasks, and a huge chunk of the variation. Executive function, we do see evidence of the kind of SES disparities that are commonly, that are, you know, well known. But those SES disparities are much narrower than what we see for executive function relationships. So all of that to say, I am not in any way surprised by this academic achievement, general intelligence. We see that very consistently across school districts, across schools, across schooling systems, is that the sort of problem solving and cognitive abilities that are tapped by these standardized tests are really similar to, you know, individual differences in what you're learning in school. I just don't think that we've had a conversation about how to make sense of that from a policy perspective.
Yeah, you're quite right. And I also really resonate a lot with your argument about flattening the hierarchy because, you know, I would argue that while these correlations exist, we create these correlations to a certain degree. Yeah, because
we
created tests unwittingly that are basically IQ tests, thinly designed. And then we said, those are the gating mechanisms. Those are, and we created a hierarchy. If you score high in those gating mechanisms, you're worthy of doing anything in your life, really. I mean, to the extent to which education is opens doors, and it's a very large extent to which higher education opens doors. We created this system. So, you know, that's why I'm all about a self-actualizing school, you know, that treats all students as human first. And,
Well, I would add to that self-actualization. And by that, I mean actualization of the talents and skills that you want, you know, as a developing autonomous agent, like find an intrinsically interesting and valuable and that you feel like is your path towards, you know, contributing to society. That needs to be matched by those self-actualized skills finding a place in our economy, right? So, you know, to say we want you to self-actualize your skills, but to be in a country where we have, for instance, like very poor labor protections for many forms of work, is encouraging the actualization of things that then make people vulnerable to, you know, I think forms of social oppression and so we need both. There's both the self-actualization, but then how does that self, those self-actualized skills find, connect to a life that isn't precarious, that isn't deprived, that isn't oppressed, that isn't exploited, is the word that I'm looking for in labor markets. I think those two things have to go together.
Dare I say, transcendence matters even more. that's the argument of in Transcend is that self-actualization is really just a bridge, and when done right, its purpose, its function is to erase itself. That's what Maslow said in a beautiful essay. Its function is to erase itself because it's making such an impact on the world in a positive way, helping society, that there is no boundary anymore between self and world. That when done right,
A beautiful idea.
Yeah. This is why I'm such a fan of Maslow. And I need to maybe talk about him too much, but it resonates with my own sort of inherent. Mm-hmm. I don't want to use the word inherent in this discussion, but my own sort of intrinsic value system.
Okay. Yeah.
So I do want to talk about group differences. You say that we must not fear that any statistical result on group differences will compromise a commitment to anti-racism and racial equality. Why is that?
Oh, gosh, such a good question. So I think of the anti-racist project and the racial equality project as being, again, it's about, do we have a system where everyone can both, in your words, actualize the skills and the talents that they have and that they want to develop, and also that those skills and talents can be connected to the world in such a way that they live a life of, security and lack of exploitation and lack of oppression. Oftentimes, there's this idea that, again, the hierarchy that we've currently constructed around certain forms of skill is inevitable. And so, the goal is to try to equalize everyone with regards to this one fetishized skill, which are like the types of problem solving that are tested by a Q test. And I think that's a really limited vision for what equality means. In some of my talks, I briefly talked about this in the book. I talk about, like, as a very concrete example, the Americans with Disabilities Act, where we're saying, you might differ in your functioning, but you are entitled to equal enjoyment of and use of this place of public accommodation. And so I'm going to recognize difference. And what I'm equalizing here is your ability to participate as a citizen, your ability to inhabit space that upholds and reflects your dignity. I think if we take that frame in which we're trying to do is create a society in which everyone can participate and contribute, the question of what are the causes of average group differences in measured psychological characteristics becomes a lot less important, right? It's drained of a lot of its toxicity. So rather than thinking the race is set up, this is the neoliberal economic race that we're in, and we need to debate why some people compete differently in that race differently than other people. Let's interrogate the race to begin with. Let's interrogate the systems of competition that gate access to sharing in wealth, to sharing in prosperity, to sharing in access to leisure and access to medical care. That's the thing that I think we should be interrogating. And if we set up those structures correctly, I think the question about, I think the group differences question loses a lot of its negative potency.
Very interesting. Thank you for laying that argument. Do you think that, there could be any valuable information gleaned once more data, large scale data on across different cultures comes out on genome-wide association studies, for instance, once the data comes in more on group differences, do you see any valuable insights coming out from that?
I mean, I think that, of course there's going to be more valuable insights as we get more data and more information. And I think the direction of GWAS and how it's been conducted within kind of narrowly defined ancestry groups and what people think that they will find as they do more kind of large scale population genetic studies is, it's such an active area of dialogue, even within population geneticists right now. Again, I want to come back to, are we using the question of cause, like what's causing group differences, to deflect us from the question of figuring out what we need to do to structure society regardless of the cause of differences between people. So generally, I think that the lesson of genetics has been like it's full of surprises and it's, it moves in unpredictable directions. I personally don't think that we're going to find, even with lots more data, any sort of convincing smoking gun about genetically caused differences that fall along racial lines. Like, that's my prior. And I also wonder about how much, how useful IQ tests could be. I mean, I cite the work of Harriet Washington in my book. As there's more attention paid to like what she calls environmental racism, as there's more attention paid to the ways in which the environments of children are unequal with regards to their exposure to toxicants, to their exposure to the impacts of climate change, I think is going to become a thing. There's a possibility that we're also going to learn a lot more on the environmental side too, if we invest resources into that.
Yeah, you've made a good point, I believe, on Sam Harris's podcast. It's a point that that the late Flynn, of the Flynn effect, also has made. There does exist a significant, on average, IQ difference in America, between African Americans and whites. That difference does exist, but that doesn't say that the cause of the genetic environmental makeup that it would account for that difference. And it could be that once you remove all the environmental disadvantages and forms of racism and forms of all these things that are suppressing that score among African Americans and average, you may actually find it is a scientifically open question, which people like Murray don't ever open up that possibility that African Americans actually score higher on average.
We don't know.
So why would you? So it kind of by assuming that it's going to come out someday that they're always going to be lower, to me is kind of like an implicit. Like if I was like they're on the stand and I was a lawyer, I'd be like, you're admitting some sort of unconscious bias.
Yeah, I think that there can be some sort of ugly racist views sort of lurking under people's fear of genetics sometimes. It's like, well, what are you afraid that we're going to find exactly? I think a lot of times people's fears around where the science will go can mask some, can be kind of indicative of some of their own prejudicial priors.
I think that's right. I also would say that no scientific finding that ever comes out is going to justify racism. And I think that's a point that needs to be made as well. I mean, what's the worst case? The worst case scenario? Let's say that like all this data does come out someday and it shows we look at the readout and it shows that all the stereotypes are true. I'm just like being cheeky and coming up with so we read the readout and it's like none of that would justify anything. The racists are still going to be racist. It's not like the racists are waiting for that data to come out so that they can start being racist. They're already racist today. And it's also not like you are waiting for the data to come out to decide. You're still going to be you. You're still going to care about treating individuals and helping people who are vulnerable, right? So in a sense, in a really like, I'm trying to really like zoom in really close to this, the heart of this question is what is the data on group difference ever really going to matter? this is the question I'm trying to get to. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, one way I think about this, one thought that keeps kind of running through my head as I hear you talk is, well, two things. One is, it is just amazing to me, like, what a black hole of gravitational force the subject of group differences is.
I know.
In the absence of any data, right? So, you know, I've written a whole book that's taking on any number of controversial issues. And the one thing that I say at the very beginning that I cannot really speak to is racial differences.
And here I am talking about it.
Race is not a genetic construct, right? It's a social construct that's correlated with ancestry, but isn't strictly genetic. And all of the studies that are in my book are about people who are of European genetic ancestry who would all be racially identified as white. And yet there is this association where it's, I think it's even stronger than the like heritability is innate association, which is that if you're talking about genes, you must be talking about race. And I just want to reflect on that, right? That like it is kind of inescapable part of our discourse. And I really do feel like, you know, on the one hand, clearing up misperceptions about what the kind of work I do has to say about quote unquote racial genetic differences is important. On the other hand, I just think there's so much more heat than light in this subject. Like it's just so much, so speculative in the absence of real evidence and so corrosive to thinking about what we do with the information that we do have, that I don't really know what to do with that. I just kind of want to reflect on that as a observation about the conversation.
Look, point very well taken. And I would like more than to now transition to about taking equality seriously and your proposals about that. But I will say, and we will transition to that, but I will say that because it is such a hot topic and because so many people, you know, in a way, a certain segment of people have controlled the narrative around that topic, that I think it's important for people like you and, dare I say, me and others who would like to think through the practical, meaningful applications of this research in a way where the goal, the explicit goal, we're not shy to say we want to help people. The goal is not just, you know, some people say, well, I'm a pure scientist. Let's look at the readouts and it will speak for itself. I don't think that the data ever speaks for itself. It's particularly, I don't think the data on group differences will ever speak for themselves. So I think there's a certain responsibility there, but yeah. I hear you and your point is taken.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, if anything, the pandemic has shown us that data never speaks for itself, right? Data, exactly. There is data and then there's how that data is interpreted and how it's used and how it's met with skepticism and how, you know, we, in every area of science, the data doesn't stand separate from the communication, interpretation, and use to which the data is put.
Yeah. Excellent point. So let's talk a little bit about this this great synthesis, which is the heart of your book, and that's really what you're passionate about. It's not like you were passionate about writing this book because you wanted to talk forever about group differences and intelligence and the genetic basis of it. Look, yeah. You're really passionate about really moving the conversation forward through this great synthesis, which is grounded in what you call anti-eugenicism. What does it mean to be an anti-eugenicist? You outline five principles. This really I think this is really where your passion lies. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah. So, you know, I think of eugenics and genetic difference are so tightly wound up in the popular imagination and in the imagination of scientists themselves. That it's hard for us sometimes to imagine that we can observe genetic differences in socially valued outcomes without that being inherently eugenic. And so when I'm describing anti-eugenics, I'm trying to say, what are the kind of flaws or assumptions, the bad ideas wrapped up in eugenic thinking? And then what is the response to them? And in a particular, how can we formulate a response in a framework that isn't, we just shouldn't be doing this research, right? Like, let's just, you know, I don't think there's putting the DNA genie back in the bottle. I don't think that there is undoing the knowledge which people already have that genetics makes a difference for people's lives. So given that, and given this eugenic history, how do we move forward? What are the next steps? So I think one of those ideas in eugenics was around, we've already touched on, was this idea that genes are destiny, that if someone has a certain set of genetic characteristics or predispositions, you know, that the effects of that are sort of written in stone, and they can only be changed through, you know, biological means. The social programs or social policies will be ineffective at fixing them, right? Whereas I think of anti-eugenics as saying, okay, given that we have data on genetics and human outcomes, what are the mechanisms by which that happens that will give us opportunities for intervention via social policy or via psychotherapy or via new education? The second kind of big framework of eugenics that's very hard for people to kind of step away from and see is this idea that genetic difference means genetic inferiority and superiority. And that's that pecking order we were already talking about. This is why I talk about my own family. So often when I talk about this is because it's easiest often for people to see how difference does not translate into differences in worth when they are thinking about their own kids or their own siblings, their own families, where you can see, well, maybe it is because of genetics that I have struggled with this relative to my sibling, or one child struggles more, but one of my children is not more valuable to me than the other one, right? So yeah. I think separating difference from hierarchy is a really important component of anti-eugenics. And then the third part is thinking about, well, like, what policies proceed from those ideas? The atrocities in the United States, where we're thinking about our eugenic history, were about justifying abridging people's freedoms, particularly their reproductive freedoms, most notably in involuntary sterilization laws. When I was a grad student at UVA, I had a practicum year at Western State Hospital in Stanton, Virginia, which is where they used to do sterilizations of women, you know, well into the middle of the 20th century. So that history is there. It's real. You know, Carrie Buck, who was the subject of the Buck v. Bell Supreme Court case, the infamous one that said, you know, three generations of imbeciles is enough, that upheld the constitutionality of sterilization laws. Wow. You know, she is buried in Charlottesville, which is where I went to grad school. So that history is very real. What is the opposite of that? So if eugenic policy is, I'm going to draw on genetics to justify abridging people's freedoms, to justify inequalities in resources and welfare, the anti-eugenic policy is one that guarantees equality of freedoms, resources, and welfare, sort of regardless of the outcome of the genetic lottery. And by that, I don't mean that everyone is necessarily going to make the exact same amount of money, right? Like the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, is not saying we are going to equalize income. It's saying we're going to equalize people's ability to participate in a public space. And I think that metaphor can be extracted out to think about not just participation in physical spaces, but in economic spaces and educational spaces, in access to healthcare spaces. Anti-eugenics is ultimately about, can we make social structures that are good for everyone, regardless of the hand that nature dealt them? That is what I think of is a kind of a good litmus test for a good social structure.
I love it. So what is the new synthesis then? And why do we need it?
So, I mean, I think the new synthesis is exactly what I just told you, which is separating, you know, genetic difference from genetic hierarchy and thinking about using genetics as a tool to identify targets for intervention rather than as a barrier to intervention. I think it's necessary because the science is accelerated so rapidly because we can observe these differences. We can observe them easily. We have this really powerful tool. If we don't come up with a new synthesis, then we are trapped in the same dilemma that we've been in for decades, which is, let's try to understand what works for kids without taking into account this major source of variation between them. And let's try to convince people that genes don't matter when they already know that they do and they can see evidence of that in their lives. And I just don't think that's a very successful strategy moving forward.
Yeah, I agree. And I love what you're saying in the main, theoretically. I want to zoom in on what this would mean practically to take into account a child's genes. I really want to double click on this because I've been critical. I've looked at the current data on linking, trying to predict individual polygenetic traits to their education. And the it's too weak. I mean, look, scientists get excited when you see like at a group level, like, oh, we found a 0.3 correlation and statistically significant. Okay, that's great. Okay, good. It does suggest we shouldn't sweep under the rug the role of genes. But when you look at individual prediction, it's not that great. I wouldn't want to hang my hat on being able to decide whether or not a child was born with quote unlucky genes based on just their polygenetic score. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, and I totally agree with you. You know, I think a lot of times, you know, most of our correlations in psychology are in 0.3 land, right?
I know, so, it's true.
You know, if we know that your family had this income in this year, that's correlated at around 0.3 with your likelihood of graduating from college. So that introduces a new kind of interesting litmus test of is what someone proposing they're doing with a polygenic score, would it be sensible if it were the same proposal for a different social science variable, one that we ordinarily kind of are used to thinking about in psychology?
Socioeconomic status.
Socioeconomic status. So let's say you had a column in your data set that was your classic, this is my composite of occupational status, income, and educational attainment of parents. And it's correlated at 0.3 with kind of everything in your data set. Is what people are proposing to do with polygenic scores, would it still make sense to do if instead that you were doing it with this SES variable? What's clarifying about that is the applications that are less sensitive to uncertainty. So if you are doing a big study of parenting practices and trying to figure out which one of these are correlated with academic achievement. It is routine to control for social class, right? Like it would be impossible to get the study published without controlling for social class because there would always be this question about like, well, is this about this parenting or is this just like an indicator of rich versus poor families? And it's a really messy predictor. It's only correlated at 0.3. But it acts as a filter of how robust are these associations to this kind of just like really broad brush stroke thing. If there was that, but in an attempt to control for genetics, and this doesn't even have to be necessarily polygenic scores, like is your correlation between parent behavior and child outcome still there when you are looking at a sample of adoptees versus, you know, kids being raised by their biological parents. Does that solve the problem of how hard causal inference is in psychology? No. Like, does that move the ball towards addressing a problem that's been pointed out for decades and still is a really glaring flaw at the heart of a lot of correlational psychology research? Yes, it does. And so a big part of what I'm saying about taking genes into account is you already do this. You already use messy social science variables to try to control for things. And now you have a new layer of information. Why are you using it? That's a big part of my suggestion to my fellow psychologists, my fellow researchers.
I hear you. And I share the frustration that social scientists, particularly like sociologists, never control for genetic variables. I don't think I've ever seen a sociology study where they're like, let's talk about the sociology of crime, but let's, you know, control for their polygenic score. So look, I completely agree that this new synthesis is going to have to take seriously the emerging data in behavioral genetics. I guess what I'm getting stuck on is the population level prediction goal and the individual. Like I'm really getting into the nitty gritty of like the concrete policy implications for, you know, because in our school education system, we do sort kids. You make the gifted education program if you score this cutoff on an IQ test. We sort you into special education if you have a learning disability. I've argued that kids can be twice exceptional. You know, they can be both gifted intellectually and have a learning disability, and haven't made room in our education system for twice exceptional kids. So I guess just I'm trying to think of your very worthy anti-eugenicist goal, but just on the ground practically in school. Because for instance, I read Catherine Asbury and Robert Pohlman's book, G is for Genes,
The Impact of Genes. And their proposals are very different than mine in a lot of ways.
There you go. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So,
So when I think of, I say this as one of the principles in the back of my book, which is that given how uncertain polygenic scores are, the uncertainty around their prediction and the opacity of their mechanisms, it's really a mistake to think of them as diagnostic tests about people.
Good.
They're a source of information about environments, actually. So when you say, okay, right now we track people into gifted programs, I immediately go to, well, but that's been a target of policy experimentation. You know, let's give everyone a giftedness test. Let's get rid of gifted programs entirely. Let's change the age at which we have gifted and talented programs. We see the same thing for math, right? Where let's detract math. Let's change how we track math. Let's detract math for 9th and 10th grade and then retrack it in 11th and 12th grade. What's so interesting to me scientifically is thinking about genetics as a tool for seeing who is being helped and who is being hurt by these policy changes. Because by measuring someone's genes, you're getting a set of information about them that is not reciprocally affected by the policy change that they were associated with, right? So this is related to what a ton of people in intervention and education are talking about is the heterogeneity revolution. Not just thinking about what are the average treatment effects of things, but what are the individual differences in the responses that we're seeing to education. Those things can be closing genetically associated gaps. They could be widening genetically associated gaps. They could be keeping them exactly the same and moving the mean. They'd be having no effect whatsoever vis-a-vis genetics. And we don't know anything about that information. So that is the part where I feel like, I give an example in my book of an evaluation of this UK policy reform that happened a long time ago that raised the school leaving age, that was able to show that it worked on average to reduce body size, but that was very small. But it had a much bigger effect amongst people who were at high genetic risk for obesity. And we would have missed the fact that even though it has an itty-bitty effect on average, it's helping the people who are most at risk for high BMI the most without that genetic information. That sort of thinking could be applied much more regularly when we're thinking about education. But again, that's using genetics as a tool for telling us something about our environment, not as a tool for telling us something about an individual kid.
Gosh, there's so much in everything you just said. There's so much. It's so rich. It's so rich that there's various components I need to break down for a second. So one major difference, as I see it, between kind of your argument and the Pohlman Asbury argument is I could see them more inclined to want school psychologists to now have readouts of the polygenic scores of the students to help inform what track they put them in. Whereas I don't see you as making that recommendation.
No, right? I'm not really advocating for like any sort of like little Tommy has a lower polygenic score than little Susie sort of thing. I think of it more like, you know, like if you go to like the What Works Clearinghouse, which is this website curated by the Institute of the Department of Education. And it's basically like a list of, well, here's outcomes from RCTs. Like, does there any, if you're a school district or you're a school administrator, and you want to know, is there any evidence that me, you know, using this math curriculum in pre-K has an average treatment effect that isn't zero for numeracy in first grade? You know, you could see that on what we're, and it grades like the quality of the evidence. What it doesn't tell you is anything around for whom is it working, right? Is it narrowing income gaps? Is it widening income gaps? And we see that there are, for reasons we don't understand, genetically associated inequalities between people. So I don't think that the school, you know, in my ideal world, the school administrator is not like, oh, we're personalizing the education for Tommy versus Susie. They're saying, yeah, this math curriculum, I know it doesn't seem like it has a very big effect or it almost looks zero, but the analysis of heterogeneity shows that it is working for the kids who are most at risk for poor outcomes. So that's the one we should go with versus this other intervention that, you know, might have a bigger average treatment effect, but is just exacerbating inequality, for instance. We don't have that information right now.
Yeah, I hear you. And I think there's just no way around the politics of this at the end of the day, because the question is, what is the focus? Now,
yeah.
I'll say when I was with you, you said, let's give everyone a giftedness test. I was like, I'm with you. And then you said, let's get rid of all gifted and talented programs. And I was like, I wasn't with you there.
I'm just talking about people, the proposals that have been thrown around, right?
I
mean,
oh,
I
thought you were saying that's what you
wanted. I'm just saying that if you look at school districts in America, what are they doing right now? They're saying, let's give everyone a gifted talented test. Let's get rid of gifted and talented. Let's change the, you know, these are things that are being proposed in our, you know, radical experiments that are being done in education right now.
Yeah. Yeah. So you weren't advocating for getting rid of gifted and talented programs.
I wasn't advocating for that.
I'm sorry.
I was simply saying that there's already experimentation with these types of things happening, who is being served and who is not being served by those.
Gotcha. I think that America has never reckoned with the equity versus excellence. Sort of, I don't even know what to call it, because as I don't want to live in a zero sum world where we either have equity or we have excellence. You know, I think we need to work on and nurture both. You know, I think that with a lot of these kids that are falling between the cracks, we almost act like the best we can do with them is to remediate them, as opposed to, well, are they capable of excellence? You know, so that's why I think that aspiring to excellence and having gifted, talented programs, but that allow all children the opportunity, is the way forward, as opposed to completely axing those programs and only focusing on remediation. So that's my own sort of view. But
I mean, I think you're right that there's this inherent tension between...
Tension, that's the word for it. Thank you.
tension between focusing on the absolute levels of skills. We want this individual child to have, you know, the most ability to do academic things as they possibly can, and the distribution and relative ordering of people's level of educational skills. And then there's also kind of a tension between, are we focused on, you know, the few people that are going to be at the highest level of performance, or, you know, the making, worrying about the floor, basically making sure that all children have a minimum. And I agree with you that I don't think that those are necessarily opposing goals. Mm-hmm. But when you start thinking about heterogeneity of treatment effects and who's being served by our policy changes, I think you're absolutely right that they do surface these tensions and these maybe more implicit conflicts that people have about really like, what is the point of education? You know, is it about, is it an equity promoting institution? Or is it an you know, getting as some few people to a certain level of technical skill that they are going to be, you know, inventing things that push society forward. Both of those things are true, but they can kind of mash up against each other around certain policy decisions.
Completely. Perhaps I will put the last word here to Maslow. Okay. He says, because it's just, it ties together so much of what we talked about today. Victory or success in life should not be defined in terms of someone else's defeat. This point must be stressed. I also must indicate that there are so many different kinds of quality, so many kinds of capacity, and so many jobs to be done that virtually anyone can be very good, even in the ordinary social sense, that is, successful in hundreds or thousands of different ways. Therefore, we all can be proud of our accomplishments and become autonomous and self-actualizing. Psychological success is a non-zero-sum game because everybody can win. Rather than seeking to defeat someone else, it is better to seek excellence and perfection in one's own accomplishments. Mm-hmm. So I kind of wanted to end on that note and say thank you.
That's a lovely place to end.
Thank you, Paige, so much for putting forward this egalitarian geneticist view that you have, this new synthesis, this anti-eugenicist idea. It is a much-needed counterbalance, but really, I think synthesis is the better word than counterbalance. It really is a synthesis of a lot of different truths that exist on both the left and right side of political ideologies. So thank you so much. And
thank you so much for having me. This was a really thought-provoking interview, and I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.